everyone, this is Scott Spinelli, and you are listening to episode 13 of I'm Sure I'm Overthinking This. This week's guest is Aaron Goldfarb. He is an author and a writer. You'll find his stuff in Esquire magazine, The Daily Beast. He's written some stuff for Playboy and a number of other publications, primarily about craft beer, bourbon, etc. Aaron is also, and this is what we primarily talk about on this podcast, as I said before, an author. His most recent two novels came out actually on the exact same day, The Guide for a Single Man and The Guide for a Single Woman, telling the story of a man and a woman on one night in New York, a drunken bar-crawling evening, and basically how those two stories intertwine and intermingle are, I think, very interesting. And I'm not just saying that because I'm friendly with Aaron. I think they're very good, and so I hope that you either buy them as a result of my vouching for it, or you buy them because, quite frankly, he's entertaining in this podcast. We talk about process and writing a lot. We talk about where the literature industry is going, how difficult it is to get things produced in certain ways, and how this era makes it easier than ever to certainly get your stuff out there. So here's my conversation with Aaron Goldfarb. All right, so what fascinates me most about reading a lot of what you've read, and I have read most of it, is that a lot of it deals with being single or characters who are single and are seemingly problems in some way, yet the view that I know doesn't seem to have that problem. You're married, your wife is lovely, your life is lovely. Things seem to be very calm and domesticated on your front. How much going forward is that going to influence whatever you write or create next?
Yeah, that's a good question. Something I've thought about a lot lately. I certainly don't want to be that guy who's writing, you know, Ray Romano living with, you know, children and can you believe they're pooping in diapers type stories. Yeah. So I don't think you're going to see that ever. And to be fair, The Guide for the Single Man and The Guide for the Single Woman were written while I was dating my wife. It was just written based on remembrances of things past. So you might see more of that. I mean, the interesting books and movies and fiction of all time is usually about single people. It's not about married people necessarily. So I wouldn't be surprised if I continue writing about single characters and maybe start adding married characters to the mix for once, and not in a cynical way.
Do you find that it's easier, though, to write now that you've experienced it? I remember my mom wanted me to write something. She wanted me to write a sitcom about, I believe it was, growing up in an Asian family. And I had to describe to her that, unfortunately, we're not Asian, and so I don't really have a lot of experiences to draw on from there. I don't think people necessarily get the idea that it is something that you need to draw from. Would you agree with that, or do you find that you can sort of pick and choose? Because obviously, The Guide for the Single Woman, you've never been a single woman, and you were able to effectively write about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of like being, or could I write about growing up as an Asian boy? Maybe, if I had it, you know, if I'd had an Asian best friend and I'd seen how he grew up, but, you know, I didn't have an Asian best friend, so that would be a real struggle. You know, no one, you know, says to J.K. Rowling, you know, you didn't grow up a wizard. How can you write about this stuff? I mean, it's a lot of imagination. Going back to your first question, writing The Guide for a Single Woman, that was informed a lot by hanging out with my wife and her single female friends. And a lot of people say I had a good ear for single women in the book. And that's because I was sitting there frequently bored out of my mind, you know, trying to watch sports or drink a beer as, you know, another one of her single friends was bitching about their love lives. So yeah, I don't think you necessarily have to be that thing to write that thing, but it would be good to, you know, embed yourself on the front lines of whatever you're writing about.
I mean, obviously, in the case of a J.K. Rowling or anything like that, I think we're talking about books, though, that are, your books are based in reality. I mean, you've talked about this before on other podcasts, the idea that like a really good way to write a book is to take a genre that's been out there and then sort of twist it a little bit. And you're doing that with a lot of the things you've put out there, and we'll get into that in a minute. But anything that's firmly entrenched in reality, I would tend to argue that you at least need to have some experience with it or close to it, because otherwise it there's so many little things that the person who is familiar with that would say, nah, that's not exactly how that went.
Yeah, I mean, I just read this novel, City of Fire. I don't know if you've heard about it. It was a big hit last year. It's a 900-page book, and it's pretty good too. And one of my areas of expertise is whiskey, which we can talk about later. And there's,
okay.
There's just one line in the book where a character from a very, very wealthy, waspy New York family, and this book takes place in the 70s, he steals some bourbon from his dad's liquor cabinet. Well, a rich, waspy New Yorker in the 70s would never have bourbon in their liquor cabinet because it just wasn't drunk. So, you know, that took me out of the book just because I had such a high level of expertise on the subject, whereas the author clearly didn't. And where 99.9% of people wouldn't think that was a weird line either. It's not his fault. It's my fault, if anything, for having that knowledge. But you're right. It's very hard to write a full, you know, 500 or 900 page novel without screwing up on something. You know, as novelists, we have to be jacks of all trade. We have to know a little bit about everything, and that gets dangerous because we know a little bit about everything and not a lot about anything. So, you know, I'm sure there's liberties and errors we all make in our novels, and I've certainly caught them when authors are trying to write about things that they clearly don't have an expertise about, just to add some flavor.
Yeah, I had that happen to me with somebody pointed out to me, this is almost embarrassing because at least bourbon is something that you can be an expert in. I don't eat breakfast, so I'm not an expert in breakfast. And right. I had a character once eating deviled eggs for breakfast, and I had people point out to me that is absolutely not a thing. I just assumed any kind of eggs were breakfast food. Apparently not the case. Anyway, I'm interested in process, and I know that sometimes that can be a little dull for certain people, but as someone who likes to write myself, and for anybody out there who actually is trying to write a novel or has written a novel or wants to write more, what is your process, or what's it been, let's say, we'll break it down first by novel. When you've written what you've written, are you alone? Do you go out in public? Are you one of those guys who likes to let people know you're writing a novel and you're at Starbucks? You know, what are you drinking? You know, run me through how it might work, time of day, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I never let someone know what I'm working on. I don't even like to tell my wife that I'm working on some stupid listicle or something. Like, I think it's really dangerous when you kind of pat yourself on the back about your writing. There's even a Twitter account that retweets people who have just tweeted that they're writing their novel, because, you know, it's saying you're obviously not going to finish your novel because you're kissing your ass too much about writing it. It's kind of the same thing with marathon running. Those people that constantly talk about how they're training for a marathon, and maybe they get to the marathon eventually, but they're kind of congratulating themselves for accomplishing something they haven't even done yet.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe I have 10 novels I'm working on right now, but I'd never tell you, and I certainly wouldn't brag about it. For the process, you know, for novels, I can really write anywhere. I like to write at home. One reason I don't like to have a job is because I like to just sit at home in a quiet house with my cat.
That's the only reason? It seems right. Like there's probably a couple other reasons why not having a job would be a good thing, but...
Yeah, I mean, I like to wear basketball shorts all day, and I'm not a basketball player. I don't like to wear shoes.
Those are all legitimate reasons, yep.
I like to eat when I want. I like to masturbate when I want. I like to watch TV in the middle of the day. I like to go drinking when I want.
Oh, these are great. I gotta, you know, at certain point, I have to find a wife that is totally cool with these sort of things, too.
Well, she has a job that she goes
to.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, no, that's what I mean. That is that, and there's no resentment. I mean, I've met your wife. She seemed to be totally cool with the, you know, she has a regular, we don't need to blow up her spot, but she has a very regular domesticated job, at least what she did when I knew of it. And
she has a job where you put on dress clothes and you go to the office.
Yeah,
for
an adult. Hours. An adult, yeah.
She has an adult job.
Yeah.
Her husband wears shorts and may or may not shower, yes.
Yeah, and so she doesn't come home and there's no resentment on the fact that you haven't moved necessarily?
You know, the first 2 years there kind of was. She didn't quite understand it. Also with writing, you can never – it's not like painting a fence. What'd you do today? I painted 10 fences. You know, what'd you do today? I wrote 50 words. What'd you do today? I wrote 10,000 words. Like, you know how it is. You can sit at the computer for 10 hours, and 10 hours could be a very productive day or an incredibly unproductive day, and it's not necessarily because you're dicking around all day. It's, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I don't have a lot of writer's block anymore. I mean, ever actually, but you know, still some days you're a lot more productive than other days.
Do you force yourself to get a certain, if you're working on a project, are you forcing yourself, all right, hey, listen, I need to at least write you know, a certain number of words. I've talked to certain writers who have said I write this amount each day, and then I'll go back and read it, and it might all be garbage, but at the very least, I got something out there, and you know, and then I can check it over the next day, that sort of thing. Or do you just, like you said, 50 words one day, 50,000 the next?
Yeah, I mean, I rarely have those 50-word days unless I'm, you know, painfully hungover or something. But, you know, I think you have to write every single day. I don't try to give myself any sort of word minimums or maximums. I think that's another dangerous thing with that, what is it, national novel writing.
I hate that thing. Yeah, NaNoWriMo. Yeah. It's the stupidest thing in the world.
It is the stupidest thing in the world. Like, that's another self-congratulatory thing. I wrote 100,000 words in a month. Well, were they good, or did you just...
Yeah, I don't understand the point of that. And again, not that I can speak from any high vaunted point of view here, but like, it just seems like it runs contrary to the whole point of actually finishing a novel. Am I wrong? Like, what's the point? What is the point of doing it in a month if it's just shit? Like, I don't get it at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think like writing a novel is such a daunting task. I think any sort of impetus that causes you to start getting words on the page is good. And I always tell people that want to write novels that are struggling where to start, don't struggle where to start, just write. You know, if you really feel good about chapter 5, start writing there. You know, just start getting those words down, and then the real work's going to be editing it. But, you know, the National Writing Month is just stupid.
Do you have in mind an ending for all of your things? You know, you say you sometimes you tell people to start wherever. Do you have the ending in mind for all of the things you start, or do you let that sort of percolate as you go?
I usually have like a good overall concept for the book. What kind of makes it interesting? What makes it a good elevator pitch or a good high concept? I usually have a good first chapter. I usually generally know how the ending's going to go, and then I can usually envision, you know, chapters and scenes and things going on in the middle of the book. So that's what I do. I usually can write the first chapter immediately, but then sometimes I do have to struggle and, you know, write something in the middle of the book I know is going to be good, and it starts building from there. I'm not a outliner, maybe to my detriment. I keep a lot of it up in my head. If I outline anything, it might be on a single piece of paper. You know, my office doesn't have a giant marker board. It doesn't have, you know, beautiful mind writings all over the wall, just plotting something out. And maybe that's why I'm not the greatest plotter of stories, which is what I think is one of my bigger weaknesses, novel writing wise. But I don't even remember where I was starting there, but go on.
Yeah, that's fine. I've heard, I don't know who it was, but one an author, might have been, is it possible it was John Updike? I don't know, said he wrote the last sentence first. And then work, which seemed asinine, quite frankly. But, you know, everyone's got their thing. And I find it interesting to go into the process of how it goes from a seed of an idea to this 300 to 400 page thing. You mentioned that you don't really like telling people when you're writing something, even your wife. As you are writing something, though, is there anybody that you will send whatever you've finished or whatever you've just finished for that day, sections, chapters, for feedback? Is this working? Is this any good?
No, I have a good faith and trust with what I'm writing, and it would totally derail me if I sent a chapter to someone and they said, even if they said it was amazing, it might derail it. But if they said it was bad, you know, it'd totally start getting in my head. You know, it's like, don't tell someone what their golf swing looks like, because then they start thinking about it. If they're playing well, just let them go. So I don't give it to anyone until I've at least written a first draft, what could be read from start to finish as a book.
And do you find that to be something that you've adopted recently because you have found success, or have you always had that sort of confidence with the, for lack of a better term, art that you are producing?
I've always had a confidence. Doesn't mean it was always good. I always hated in classes, writing classes, and I mainly took screenwriting classes at Syracuse. I was more aspiring to be a screenwriter than any sort of prose writer. I always hated when we'd have to read like scenes of a screenplay and process, like for feedback. I hated that. Like, what did a single scene tell the whole group? If they praised it, well, okay. And if they ripped on it, well, maybe they don't understand where things are headed or where this is placed, or, you know, why are we even wasting our time doing this? So I always hated that. I've never been one of those people who, you know, joins the local writers group where we all sit around reading our chapters and stuff. That's just, you know, I'm the, you know, rogue writer just sitting by myself with my cat writing and hoping it works out.
Right now, obviously, you're doing a lot of writing for online publications and such. Esquire, I know you were doing stuff for Playboy. Is that still, you still writing for them at all? Or?
Yeah, I've written for Playboy a few times. I mean, you know, in the freelance writing world, you kind of have an idea, figure out where it works, and sell it to them. So, yeah, I love Playboy. I still think it's one of the best places to write, and they pay very well in this era. But, yeah, I haven't written something for them in a few months. But, yeah, I'd love to write stuff for them in the future, of course.
So, obviously, you're writing for a number of different publications. You've written books. You've written screenplays that haven't necessarily made it to the big screen. So you've done a bunch of writing of all varieties. Do you have a favorite thing, you know, not project that you've worked on, but if you could choose, money is all equal, and you could make it the one thing you were doing, which of those three would it be?
What were my three choices?
The three things, the screenwriting, novel writing, and writing. I mean, you primarily write about beer and alcohol, right? I mean, that's, for lack of a better term, I guess, do you consider yourself a beer snob?
Yeah, I consider myself a snob in a lot of things.
That's okay. Fair enough. So anyway, do you what would you prefer to do if you could only do one of the three of those, whether it's novel writing, screenwriting, or writing about, you know, your passion, which is obviously, you know, beer and liquor and such.
Yeah, well, you know, I kind of look, oddly enough, at my magazine writing is kind of like my hobby, or kind of like, you know, the creative writing professor job that a novelist takes, like make some loot. I enjoy it. It's fun. But, you know, my passion from high school through college and even still today is screenwriting for feature films and television. And maybe the fact that that's where I've been least successful in life is why that's where I most want to be successful or not. I don't know. But, I have a great TV project. Maybe other people don't think that's what I'd like to be working on right now if I could.
Now, for those people who don't know, let's just talk a little bit about the depressing world of screenwriting for a minute. You and I have talked about this. You've written a number of screenplays that haven't really quite gotten anywhere, but I think that's the case for a lot of people. I mean, it seems like that's and by not gotten anywhere, that doesn't mean they're sitting in a file somewhere. You've had stuff that's been optioned, correct?
Sure. Yeah.
Now, what does that even mean? All right, explain that to people. I mean, I have a sense for what that means, but for someone listening that isn't quite familiar with it, you write your screenplay, and then how the hell, what does it even mean to be optioned, and how does something get optioned?
Yeah. So Hollywood likes to spend money on things that may not ever come into the world, and they want to lock up rights to things. So sometimes frequently they'll do what's called an option on a screenplay, or a project. They could option your book. And they'll usually pay you 10% of the final price of the product. And then you would get the full amount on the first day of that the movie starts shooting, that the cameras start rolling. So, you know, it can be $5,000, $10,000. You know, if you had a really great book, you know, I'm sure Michael Lewis's books get optioned for millions of dollars, or at least hundreds of thousands of dollars. So, you know, it puts a little money on the table, but then these things almost never actually get made, and studios and production companies just have a giant, giant, you know, treasure chest of products they've optioned that never go anywhere and really were just a waste of money. So that's happened to me a few times when I was younger and really focused on screenwriting, which I don't focus on as much anymore. And it's frustrating, you know.
How do you, when you have an idea, how do you know what it's best for? You know, when you have a really good idea, like the two books that you just most recently released, the Guide for the Single Man and the Guide for the Single Woman, and we'll get into those specifically in a bit. But how do you decide this is probably better for a screenplay, or this might be work better as a novel? How do you make that determination?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, in the early 2000s, when I was just out of college, I would force feed every single idea into a screenplay because that's what I wanted to do. Even How to Fail, my first novel, I think I wrote a screenplay of it before realizing, oh, this would work much better as a book, and then writing it as a book. Now, for the Guide for the Single Man and the Guide for Single Woman, believe it or not, those were actually envisioned as movies. There was a Walter Matthau movie in the 50s or 60s called The Guide for a Married Man, And it was kind of like what I was trying to do. It was a series of vignettes where a married man was telling the recently married Walter Matthau, you know, how to exist as a married man. So my friend and manager at the time, Craig Wood, tipped me off to that movie, and it's not a good movie. And he said, you should do the guide for a single man. And I had another idea at the time that I thought it would be very cool if someone released two movies at the same time that you had to watch both of them. When I was in college, I was told, you know, each week the studios release a guy movie and a girl movie. They still do it today. You know, if you see what's coming out this Friday, you know, there's a superhero movie for the guys, and then there's a Reese Witherspoon movie for the girls. You know, Hollywood doesn't think you know, we can watch each other's movies. So I thought, what if one studio, one production company, one man owned both the guy and the girl movie for a single weekend? You know, they'd hit a home run. Now, of course, that was the ridiculous idea of a 22-year-old to think he could not only sell one movie, but he could sell two movies and get them both shot at the same time and released at the same time and in theaters at the same time, where you'd watch a movie and then walk across the hall, buy some popcorn, and go into another theater and watch the second movie. It's an absurd idea. Would have been awesome, but it's an absurd idea. So as you know, it got into the, you know, 2010s, 2012 or so, I thought, you know what, that's never going to happen. You know, even if I was Steven Spielberg, they wouldn't make that movie. And I decided to kind of take apart my screenplay and turn it into a book, where it was probably more appropriate.
When you you mentioned the sort of books and the movies that are out there right now, the guy movie, the girl movie, and it just seems like nowadays a lot of the movies that are out there are just re-dug up crap, you know, sort of the same old shit. As someone who, I would imagine, prides himself on not just writing quality stuff, but writing clever stuff. I mean, the stuff you've come out with seems to approach things from a very fresh angle. Do you get pissed off when you see all this repetitive crap on TV and movies and think to yourself, God, my shit is... It's not even that it's better or worse. It's just, at the very least, it's the same level of shit as this.
Yeah, I mean, that's another reason it's almost funny for me to talk of the idea of optioning things. You know, in the 80s and 90s, you know, you could write a screenplay and it could get optioned for a fortune, an original screenplay I'm talking about. You know, but nowadays, no one really cares about originality. So the things that are getting optioned are books that have already done well and comic books that have done well. You know, I'm sure the life story of the baby that fell into the gorilla cage just got optioned for the big screen. Yeah. You know, memes are getting optioned nowadays. So to just sit, you know, bang out a 100-page screenplay on an original idea and sell it, you know, that's kind of like late 90s, early 2000s, like when you could write an American Pie and sell it for $1 million. That doesn't really happen as much anymore.
Do you think that's coming back, though? I mean, at a certain point, and I'll be honest with you, I'm into some of these superhero movies to a certain degree, but you got to figure we're jumping the shark, right, at a certain point. Like, where does it end? We're not going to be doing, at least I hope we're not going to be doing, you know, the Avengers 15. So does it ever come back? I mean, do you think it comes back in terms of there's a point where people will say, you know what, maybe we don't spend as much money, but we make a little bit more of these movies that are more original, and thus we don't need to make $500 million on this movie because we didn't invest as much?
I mean, yes and no. You asked the previous question if you know, Avengers 15 makes me mad. No, you know, that's something that makes like a college kid full of piss and vinegar mad who thinks he's writing great stuff. Like, it's just irrelevant. You know, it's like, you know, whatever. It's like us going to the park and shooting baskets and being mad Kevin Durant makes $100 million a year. It's just we're not working in the same atmosphere. But yeah, I don't think the big studios are ever going to go back to like the 1970s era where, you know, classy movies are being funded for the big screen. But then again, The Revenant, you know, was funded for, you know, I think $100 million and it made like $500 million. And that's hardly a movie anyone would call, you know, anything but, you know, just a big screen art house movie.
Sure, sure.
But it needs a Leo DiCaprio. For guys like us, who are generally nobodies, if we want our projects to get out there, you know, there's a whole new world for that, whether it's video on demand, Netflix, Hulu, could be TV shows. I mean, when I got out of college, there were about 300 movies a year released, and I tried to see most of them. Now there's thousands upon thousands. I mean, everyone's gone on Netflix and seen a movie that sounded interesting and gone, that came out last year. I've never heard of that, and it has stars.
Yep, so, exactly, yeah.
It is a great time to be a producer of content. It's just, you know, our movies, if we write movies and they're sold, are never going to be in shopping malls and you know, 5,000 screens. They're going to be on Netflix, so they're going to be $4.99 video on demand, which is fine.
You said to me a while back something that I have that stayed with me for a very long time, and it relates to what we're talking about now, that in this day and age, you can either wait for someone to pick you or you can pick yourself. I don't know if you remember saying that to me. There was about 15 purple monkeys drank that night, so it was probably in the midst of one of them. But at any rate, I think that ties in obviously to what you're talking about now, that you can sort of go in alternative routes to get your content out there. Do you find that that's actually advice that you still would give to people? I mean, we first spoke about this probably 3 or 4 years ago at this point. Do you think that that's still a viable thing? Someone has an idea, a project, something they want to do. Is it worth it to do the Kickstarter route, to do the self-publishing route, the, you know, whatever it may be, or does it just depend on the quality of the idea?
Yeah, and to be fair, that pick yourself concept, I stole from Seth Godin, so I'm sorry if I convinced you while you were drinking that it was my own idea, but I still agree with it.
Well, I'm going to pretend it's yours if you don't mind. I'm sure he has enough.
He has enough ideas.
He has enough of his stuff. I've actually been, not that anyone quotes me, but in any interview I've ever done, I've referenced that. So that's yours. That is yours. Okay. As far as I'm concerned, that's yours.
Yes, but I do still agree with it. And you know, because of that, I kind of disrespect myself. Like, why don't I try to fund my own movie? It's the best era ever to do that. You know, I make excuses. I'm 37 years old. I'm married. I'm making a comfortable living, writing books and articles for Esquire, you know, but I'm really being a piece of shit, you know. Like, if I cared that much about getting something made, I'd do what the Broad City Girls do and start shooting a TV show and changing my life. So yeah, it's a great time to do that. It's easier, of course, to write your own book and self-publish that. It's easier to be funny on Twitter. It's easier to have a blog that gets noticed. It's easier to take amazing photographs on Instagram. But yeah, You can do this stuff. I mean, how many times have we been on Reddit and seen a guy who, you know, carves knives for a living, or, you know, does, you know, some arts and craft? It makes the front page, and the guy now has a career doing that stuff. It's a great era for that.
Now, you mentioned being funny on Twitter. We've talked about the writing that you do that's much different than the books that you write. Do you find that there's any sort of correlation between the Twitter following you have, the writing, as you called it, your hobby, that portion of your life and driving people towards the other stuff that you do?
No, not at all.
Why do you think that is?
You know, it's a good question. Every single article I write, which, as you said, is usually on beer or drinking, you know, the article ends and it says Aaron Goldfarb's the author of blah, blah, blah books, and there's usually a link to them. And even when those articles do massive numbers, you know, I wrote an article for Esquire a few years ago that I'm sure a lot of people read, where Jim Cook of Sam Adams taught me his secret for drinking all night and not getting drunk. He eats yeast. That did, you know, I think that did tens of millions of views and Facebook shares. Did I sell any books because of that? One, maybe two. I don't know. It's really hard
to sell. That's unbelievable. That's unbelievable.
Yeah. It does add Twitter followers, though. When one of my articles does well, I add hundreds of Twitter followers. Which is funny, because people always ask, you know, what's the best way to get Twitter followers? And they think it's, you know, tweeting something funny all day long. And actually, it's not. Every time I try to tweet something funny, I usually lose followers because they're offended. When I just sit there and do nothing, I gain followers because they're reading my articles, they're doing whatever. So, you know, I'm maybe not the best person to talk to about that, but I don't think the different aspects of a career necessarily overlap with each other. I'm not sure, though.
It's very strange to me because, and maybe this is just the way I look at it, but like if I hadn't heard of you and then I read one of your articles and I like the tone of it, mm-hmm. it would seem natural to me instinctively to just go to whatever yeah. else you were doing. I mean, I'm a naturally curious person in that regard as far as things I like. Like if I like a musician, a rapper or whatever, I'm going to go see more of what they've done once I find one thing I like. Like if I like Aaron Goldfarb, I'm going to hear, like if I was listening to this and I found you funny and entertaining, I'm going to go look up what else you've done. I mean, that doesn't seem like an incredible leap, but apparently it sort of is.
Yeah, well, you have to remember a lot of people still just demand free content, you know?
Yeah, well, that is a sort of a double standard that I would imagine we all live, because I don't know about you, but I don't really pay for music or porn that often. And I would imagine, and then yeah, at the other side of my mouth, I'm asking people to give me, you know, $3.99 for a book that they don't even want to read, you know? So it's, I understand. Yeah, there's a definite double standard there, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I give too much free content to the internet and they figure, you know, why read his book? I don't exactly know.
Do you think that there's a limit there, a tipping point? Because you and I have talked a lot about the idea that one of the best ways to get yourself out there is, unfortunately or fortunately, depending upon the perspective you come from, is to give away some of your stuff for free, whether it's, you know, a free run of ebooks, which probably was easier back in the day, but, you know, or like, you know, 99-cent ebooks, that sort of thing. Do you find that there's a tipping point where there is that point where people say, you know, maybe if I just wait, I can get it for free, or any promotion is good promotion?
I still think it's a good era for giving away stuff for free. I can't remember who said it, but, you know, it's better to be, you know, the guy who's not making money that people know about than just completely obscure. So if you give away some books, give away some articles, you're, of course, giving away your tweets for free. And it builds you some fans. It generally helps in the long run, I think.
You've done the self-publishing route, the traditional publishing route. The most recent books that you've written were obviously through, I believe it was FG Press. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then you've done other books you put out yourself. If you say you finish another book this afternoon, what would you, based on your experiences with both, what would you choose? To do it yourself or go through another publishing house?
You know, that's a great question, and it's something I still think about. It's maybe why I'm less hesitant to keep cranking out books. I've actually kind of flopped back to thinking the major publishers are the way to go nowadays. You know, there used to be kind of a moneyball thing, a good value in self-publishing. You know, you could control the price, you could do weird, you know, promotions and stuff. But now there's, I don't know, 100 million books on Amazon, so it's harder to get through the noise, where the major publishers still do have that power to get you in an airport or a bookstore, or, you know, make a cool video for your stuff. If you're an exceptional marketer, not just a good marketer, an exceptional marketer, I could see self-publishing as still being good. I think I'm a good marketer, not exceptional. It's very time-consuming, and you got to be really tireless to be exceptional. And, you know, that's not something I like to do. I like to write, not market.
Sure.
So, yeah, I think the major publishers are back to being the way to go if you are writing novels. It's a little different if you've written a nonfiction book where, you know, you have a point, how to make $1 million in a week, how to lose weight, how to have awesome abs. Like, no one cares who publishes those books. If it's solving a problem for a person,
sure.
They're going to take a leap. But a novel doesn't solve a problem for anyone except for maybe boredom. So, you know, you got to get that in front of as many people. And for better or worse, I've gone back to thinking the major publishers are the best for doing that.
How does one do that? That's another question that I would imagine a lot of people, if anyone's listening to this that is a writer, how the hell do you do that? All right. I mean, what is the process? You try to get an agent first? Do you go through a smaller house maybe? Or do certain houses not have agents? I know some of the answers to these questions, but for somebody who is not familiar with the process, how, you know, you say it very casually because you've had some success and you have connections. But for someone who's just starting out, how the hell do you get that really great book of yours in front of, you know, a house, really?
Yeah. I mean, and to be fair, it's not like Random House printed 1 million copies of my last book or something. So, you know, maybe you should interview Malcolm Gladwell or something.
He's coming up next week. He was next week. Yeah. He wasn't available on Wednesday afternoon. So unfortunately,
Got me on short notice because
exactly.
I'm from home. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, this is also a great era for being able to literally email anyone on planet Earth. Now, a lot of people that work at Random House or whatever, they're probably not going to accept a copy of your book, but you can email just about any agent. You can find their information, you know, see what books you like or you think your book is kind of similar to, and find out who that guy or that gal's agent is, and shoot them an email. Now, you know, they're probably not going to respond to your email if you're just Joe Schmo. But, you know, if you have a little credentials, if you've written a few articles for Esquire, if you've got 10,000 Twitter followers, if you have a little something, maybe they'll read the first 10 pages and you can work from there. It's not easy. That's what another reason why I think for a first-time author, it might be better to self-publish a good book or to just start giving us stuff away free so they can start building those credentials and that kind of resume of content and fans, so that next time, the next book, they can go to an agent, and a smaller agent probably, and say, you know, I have 10,000 Twitter followers. My last self-published book sold 20,000 copies. I got, you know, 1,000 reviews on Goodreads. And that's something, you know. These agents are trying to make it just as much as we are. And if they can discover the next, you know, J.K. Rowling's or Malcolm Gladwell, you know, that's going to be good for their career too. So they're not just sitting there wanting to reject every dude that emails them.
As far as those rejections are concerned, I'm sure you've had your share. Was there ever a point where, and I don't see this being the case for you, but where you started sort of began to doubt yourself about whatever it was that you were working on or your ability to ever get this done, you know, get this being this book, this project, whatever it was?
Yeah, I mean, when I was in my early 20s and I couldn't sell anything. I couldn't do anything. I just thought everyone else was an idiot and I was awesome. They were probably right, actually, at the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, then as I got to my late 20s and wrote How to Fail, I knew that was a good book. I knew that was a good project. So rejections didn't matter to me. If they said, you know, this book's good but overly long, or it's too lurid, or that, I would take that to heart. But just categorical rejections, no. I knew that was a good project, and I knew it would eventually find a home and sell well. I mean, you have to remember, there's so many books out there, and you know, even your buddies don't like the movies and books you do. So it's not weird if people dislike your project.
We've hinted about this for a couple of times now. I think one of my favorite things about the stuff you've written is that it takes a you all right over there?
Yeah, I just had a sip of water.
All right, good. I think what I like about your stuff that you do as far as novels are concerned is it takes a topic that is relatively regular, right? There's no spaceships, there's no fighting aliens or anything like that. And then it gives it a spin that you're like, wow, I never really thought about that. I mean, you obviously had the, as you call it, the world's first self-hurt guide, the opposite of a self-help guide, and then the guide for a single man and a single woman, which even if you didn't enjoy the books, I think they're clever. I think they're flat out clever. So if you don't like the writing at all, which I did, but I think they're just clever. So my question, the long-winded question that's been couched in this enormous compliment is, when you're coming up with something, how much onus do you put on yourself to make it unique as opposed to just an idea you would like, or are those two things intertwined?
Well, you know, I've always liked to be clever. I'm probably too clever for my own good. But, you know, in my other job, my day job, I'm trying to figure out, you know, clever stories to actually write about. So I know, as someone who's pitched all day, every day by beer companies and whiskey companies and bars and celebrities and whatnot, you know, what's an interesting story and what's not. Like, you know, this beer is good is not a story. This beer was brewed on the moon is a story. So, you know, I try to come up with book ideas that you could easily write about too. You don't even have to read How to Fail to write a 500-page article about the world's first self-hurt guide. You don't even have to read The Guide for the Single Man and The Guide for Single Woman to know that's kind of a story. Here's a guy who wrote two books and released them on the same day, and only one other person has done that. Those are articles that can be written without even necessarily reading the book or necessarily enjoying it. So that's kind of like what I like to start with when I'm writing something.
So now a lot of the stuff you've done has been, you sort of casually said, I'm not an exceptional marketer. I think some of the stuff you've done has been pretty clever. Obviously, we talked about the guide for the single man and woman, but you had the beer tour, or the bar tour, I should say, for the self-hurt guide. How annoying do you find it to have to be so involved in your own self-promotion? Do you find that tiresome when you meet someone at a party or an event? Do you even tell them that you're an author? Like, is it where there's a lot of questions in here, but you get what I'm getting at. Like, does it get ever tiring to have to keep plugging your own stuff?
Yeah. And, you know, going back to my book ideas and, you know, the bar tour, one of my favorite writers is this guy, Ryan Holiday. And one of his books is called Growth Hack Marketing. And a growth hack is marketing that's built into the idea. So the world's first self-hurt guide, that's the growth hack. It's marketing that's innate of itself. So I do like that kind of marketing. But the other kind of marketing where, you know, you're constantly having to be on and selling, it's tough. I spent pretty much all of 2011 doing self-promotion for myself. And I didn't make a lot of money that year because I had no time to do anything else. You know, it's a full-time job. It's why, you know, Malcolm Gladwell probably has 10 people on his team promoting his books. It's tiring to constantly email people, to constantly set up interviews, to constantly do podcasts and whatnot to promote. You know, this podcast is fun, but
yeah,
will I sell 5 books from it? I don't know.
I have hope for you that you will, but based on your negativity, I don't think you will. has anybody ever commented that some of this shit is a little gimmicky? Do you ever get that from anybody?
That's a good question. And I wouldn't even be insulted if they said it was gimmicky. It is gimmicky.
By the way, I'm not suggesting that it is. I'm just curious if people, I'm reserving my opinion on that, but I'm curious if anyone's ever been said, if that's ever been said to you.
I don't think so. It seems like something someone would say to me. People are generally very rude to authors. You know, I could have written that.
Yeah. I've had that happen to me before.
What's so great about that? I mean, if someone said it was gimmicky to me, I'd say, yeah, it is gimmicky. But, you know, we kind of live in an era where I think people really like gimmicks. People, whether they want to admit it or not, like clickbait. So, you know, I wouldn't even care if they said it was gimmicky.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, and you hinted on this before, and I hesitate to put myself in a similar category as you because you've done a lot more, obviously, than I have. But it's of that same nature that people, it's almost like novel writing is similar to running a marathon in that I think it just requires a lot of dedication and everyone has some level of access to it nowadays. But it does seem like people want to very quickly let you know everything that is wrong with it as if they're experts, you know, and I don't think there is an expert necessarily. I don't think, like you mentioned, you know, your buddies don't like the same movies that you like, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think that within the novel writing community, though, and that's sort of why I asked you about, you know, where do you get feedback? It doesn't seem like people always have your best interest in mind. It's sort of like, you know, those horror stories you hear about, you know, in a comedy writing room about everybody out for the next person. That sort of thing really, I think, exists in that community. I don't know if you found that to be the case.
Yeah, I think it's true. You know, people both kind of admire the fact that you could produce a book, but they really don't respect it. You know, if you had a movie out there, people would be blown away and everyone would be surrounding you at a party. But, you know, books, I don't know. They're kind of cool. Everyone kind of thinks they could write one if they just sat down and did it. Maybe they could, but, yeah, people are a lot more dismissive of books. I don't know. It's the era we live in. The average person reads less than one book a year. So,
is that true?
That is true. So, you know, I wrote 2 books in 1 year, and I guess they only get to read one of them.
Does that make what makes you more concerned? The fact that like the traditional book is going away, or the fact that people just don't read books that much anymore? Period.
Well, the traditional book going away, and I take it you mean paper book going away.
Yes.
Doesn't concern me that much. And I don't even know if the numbers completely check out, but book buying is actually trending up. And maybe that's because there's 100 million books out there. And if everyone tells their mom to buy the book, it's going to keep, you know, Jeff Bezos rich. But people are still buying books. You know, we ride the subway. Everyone has a Kindle or an iPad. And those people that aren't playing, you know, some stupid Candy Crush game are usually reading what looks like books. So, you know, it doesn't concern me. I make more money writing, you know, short-term articles on Esquire than I do writing books nowadays. So if the world decides they don't want 500 pages slapped together and would rather just read 1,000 words at a time, it, you know, financially it doesn't hurt me. But I don't know. I think eventually books are kind of going to be like opera or the ballet. It'll be, you know, something some people read, higher brow people maybe read.
Oh, God,
you know,
that's terrible. What do you read? What sort of stuff do you read?
I read a lot still. I kind of alternate between novels and nonfiction books. I like to read stories of entrepreneurs and, you know, goofy stories about overcoming odds and whatnot. I, believe it or not, just read the story of Ty Warner, the creator of Beanie Babies. It's a hell of a read. It's not written by him. It's written by an investigative journalist.
You're being serious or sarcastic?
I'm being 100% serious. I forget the name of the book. Let me see if I can find it on my shelf. I don't even see it. Believe me, every person that came over to my house while I was reading it and saw it on the coffee table completely mocked me. It was one of the most riveting books I've read in a while.
Hold on. I can't just let you go. Wait. What in the world could be? I mean, they weren't even riveting as an actual doll. What was so riveting about reading about the creation of them?
That's not what the book was about. The book was about why did these stupid little $5 toys become a phenomenon?
It's not about the man. It's about the phenomenon of the doll.
It's about the man, it's about the doll, and it's about the phenomenon. And stuff like that interests me. I'm interested in virility. And, you know, Beanie Babies were something that went viral kind of before the internet or right as the internet was coming on. So I enjoy reading those stories and kind of trying to translate them to my life. You know, what was Ty Warner doing with $5 dolls that maybe I could do with you know, $10 books?
Were you how old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
37. I do mind, but I'm 37.
I love when people – well, I actually love the question I just, do you mind, as if you're going to say no and I'm going to stop asking the question anyway.
Right.
I'm going to do it anyway, so here comes a brief, polite caveat. Did you didn't get wrapped up in all of that, did you? You were probably too old for that, I would imagine.
Yeah, I was a hair too old for it. I was a freshman in college, and one of the greatest pranks of my life, my roommate and I posted – I don't even know what was used back then, message boards, forums, probably listserv. We posted that the nerdy kid across the hall had some really crazy Beanie Babies on this listserv. Next thing we know, all of Syracuse's oldest soccer moms are coming into the dorm looking to buy, you know, Gonzo the Rabbit or whoever the hell was the Beanie Baby. It was one of the greatest pranks of all time. So actually when we saw that happening, my friend and I decided to start jumping around to gift stores to see if we could actually get in on the craze. But by then it was too late and there was no money to be made.
The only Beanie Baby story I have, is that I went to a Yankee game if I was a real big fan, I'd remember the year, but David Wells threw a perfect game and they were giving away.
Yeah, I think that was 2000. Yeah.
So I was at that game. And there were tons of fans who came for just the Beanie Baby and then left, like, just so they could get the Beanie Baby because it was a collector's item, and then they missed out on a perfect game. And you deserve your fate, honestly. I don't care if you're not that big of a sports fan or not. I mean, you deserve your fate if you are more obsessed with this bag. I mean, this unattractive – I mean, you had to – I feel like even back then, you had to be able to say that, like, this won't last forever. Like, baseball cards haven't lasted forever. There's no way – like, it was a trend. It was obviously very viral, or I don't even – like you said, I'm not sure that was the term for it back then. But, you know, it was a big deal, but no one – I mean, you didn't – no one really thought this is going to last forever. Anyway, we're coming towards the end here, and as we do, I like to ask – the person that I'm interviewing a question, I like to let them ask me a question, sort of like in job interviews, when you talk with someone for a long time and then eventually at the very end, they've answered all of your questions. Mm-hmm. And then that person says to you, do you have any questions for me? And you're stunned and you have nothing to ask, but you have to ask something because it's sort of embarrassing that you have nothing to ask and you want to get the job. So you don't want to get a job with me, but I am now going to turn it over to you for your question for me.
Okay. Who do you think is the most famous person you can actually get on this show?
Ooh, wow. That's a good question. That's a really good question. The most and how do you define famous? Like everyone knows them or like most Twitter followers or?
I mean, any number of ways, you know. I don't know who your current record is for most Twitter followers. That's usually a pretty good measure. At the same time, Charles Barkley's not on Twitter and
yeah,
I guarantee he's more famous than me.
Yeah, so, no, that's a fair point.
You know, you can define it however you think. Maybe it's a famous video game player. Maybe it's just someone I've never heard of with a million Twitter followers, or it's a legitimate celebrity.
I will say this. Okay, so as I look back to my list, and you're on this list. I'm going through it right now. The people that I think probably the most like famous in terms of Twitter followers that I could get on here right now without any direct connection, and I will have him on eventually, but he's going through some new career stuff, and I want to wait till all that settles for him, is Nick Wright. I don't know if you know him at all.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know him?
I don't think so.
He's working for Fox Sports 1 right now. I have a background in sports, so I guess that's where a lot of that comes from. The one person I think that could be the most famous, and this is probably a pie-in-the-sky thing, but I'd have to reach through a connection or two, would be Matthew Berry. The fantasy. He used to.
Syracuse's own.
Exactly. He used to write the humor column at the DO that I used to write. And obviously, he's gone on to write a few prolific things. Crocodile Dundee 2, I think. And, you know, a couple of fantasy.
Crocodile Dundee in LA, actually.
Oh, excuse me. And so he is the one that I think I could I don't even want to say probably, that I. That would be the most famous person that I could get without like an extreme stretch.
Here's the problem. He just had a book that came out last year and he was going on every single podcast on planet Earth. That would have been the time. So I think you're going to have to wait for his next book.
Yeah. Well, also, I discovered podcasts at a time when everyone else is doing them. I've gotten that question from people a lot, like, why the hell are you even doing this? And that's a fantastic question because I don't have an answer for it. And eventually, actually, that brings me up to another thing. And I know we're sort of skipping around here, but I'm close to finishing something of my own. And I wonder, when you're finishing a project that you've been so, is ensconced the right word? Entrenched in, you've been with these characters for such a long time. What is your emotion as you finish? Is it like, you're a little sad to give it up. You're nervous because you now know that the real hard work of selling it comes about. What does it feel like to be near being done or to actually finish a project that you've been working on for 6 months, 12 months, a year and a half?
By finish, do we mean first draft finished? Do we mean...
First draft finished.
Okay. That's not that exhilarating because you know now's the hard part of editing it.
Yeah, sure.
If you mean, you know... I'm done and I'm sending it off to an editor or to someone who could give me money for it. That's a pretty exciting feeling.
Do you ever annoyed that you're not annoyed, but I guess, do you ever find it difficult to let go of those characters? I guess that's because when you do the first draft, I mean, generally speaking, you've put out what you want to say and you know that there's going to be changes and edits and ads and such, but like, that's pretty much what you wanted to do and say with these characters who are in some ways, at least in the stuff I've written, and I would imagine some of the stuff you've written, pieces and sections of your life. You know, like, this character has a piece of you. This woman was maybe someone you dated. This friend was someone you might have had a little bit of something with. You know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever feel sadness of having to let them go, or does that not ever cross your mind?
Yeah, I don't really think it crosses my mind. I think it was Bret Easton Ellis once that said all his books are emotional autobiographies. Like, these things didn't happen to him, but, you know, he's writing what he felt at the time. And that's maybe what I do too. So, you know, even if I send the book off or the article off to an editor, you know, my emotions are still in me, so I haven't lost anything. So I've never really been, I've heard of those annoying novelists who, you know, say they cried because they would never again get to write about someone, or, you know, they killed off one of their beloved characters and it saddened them for a week. That's, I don't know. That seems like bullshit, but who knows?
No, yeah, that's a little over the top, obviously. Anyway, as we wrap up here, let's plug a few things for you. You've got a bunch of shit out there. What do you want people to read or see first? This is coming out later today, by the way.
Okay, great. Yeah, if you follow me on Twitter, Aaron Goldfarb, I pretty much use it as an RSS feed so you can see everything I'm writing. You're not going to get a lot of, you know, live blogging of the Oscars and trying to make hilarious jokes about the debates. I don't exactly do that because everyone else is trying to do that, and I figure I can maybe be above that. If you go on Amazon, I got 5 books, 3 novels. There's How to Fail, my first book, The Self-Hurt Guide, and my 2 books we discussed, The Guide for a Single Man and The Guide for a Single Woman. You can read them in either order. And there was actually just a new special release of it where both books are put together in one volume. And I think that's like $11. So it's probably the best way to get it nowadays.
All right, man. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Absolutely. It was fun.
All All right, everybody, you heard the man. That's where you can go get his stuff, and that's what you can go get. The book is out, available as one whole volume now, The Guide for a Single Man and The Guide for a Single Woman. You can follow him on Twitter, at Aaron Goldfarb, as he said. Puts out everything that he is doing, so if you found him entertaining, look him up there. At Spinelli underscore Scott is where you can find me. Keep leaving the reviews and all that good stuff on the podcast, for the podcast on iTunes. I'm sure I'm overthinking this, and we will catch you next week.